You're listening to the Reading Envy podcast, where I'll have what you're reading. Hi, everyone. This is Jenny, and you're back with the Reading Envy podcast. Today is a bit of an unusual episode. I'm going to start with an interview with Marie Benedict and Victoria Christopher Murray, authors of The Personal Librarian. And that just really got me thinking about books about librarians and libraries. And so the second half of this episode will be recommendations for books on those themes. Thank you for listening. Hi, everyone. This is Jenny Colvin, and I'm here today with authors Marie Benedict and Victoria Christopher Murray, authors of The Personal Librarian. Personal Librarian is about the description. Bella DaCosta Green is given the opportunity of a lifetime to be the personal librarian to prominent financier and banker John Pierpont Morgan. The newly built Pierpont Morgan Library is hers to curate, and she soon becomes a fixture in the art world and J.P. Morgan's personal confidant. With impeccable taste, shrewd negotiation skills, and an unparalleled fashion sense, Belle takes New York City by storm and helps Morgan build a world-class collection. All the while, Belle is hiding a secret that has the power to destroy the reputation she worked so hard to forge, a secret that would bar her from the very institution she ran. She was born not Belle DaCosta Green, but Belle Marion Greener, daughter of Richard Greener, the first Black graduate of Harvard, and a well-known advocate for equality. In order to protect herself from post-Civil War society, which was still gripped by rampant racism, she abandons her name and fabricates a white identity that will allow her to access the opportunities she deserves. But as she gets closer to J.P. Morgan, experiences her first romance with a fellow curator, and builds the Morgan Library to international prominence, Belle finds herself torn between her desire for success and her yearning to be herself, surrounded by the expectations of others and the harsh realities of American society. Belle must decide, once and for all, who she will be. So, welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
I'm excited to have you. So, I'm going to start with Marie. Who is Belle DaCosta Green, and how did the idea for the novel come about?
Oh, wow. Belle DaCosta Green is so many things, but we'll start with how the novel came about and kind of build up to who she is, because she's a brilliant, bold, complicated character who had a secret. I first became aware of Belle DaCosta Green when I was still a New York City lawyer many years ago. And I would kind of trot out to the various cultural institutions in New York to kind of escape and imagine a different life. And I was at the Morgan Library, which, for people who aren't familiar with it, is an absolutely stunning jewel box interior of a library in New York City that J.P. Morgan built in the early 1900s to house his own personal collection of rare and priceless manuscripts and Renaissance artwork. When I was in his institution, still looks almost exactly like it did during his time. And I loved to go there and imagine a different existence. And a docent one day happened to mention Belle. The fact that Belle DaCosta Green had been hired by J.P. Morgan when he first built the library to serve first as the library, and then she eventually became the curator, the collector, the representative, the negotiator, so much more, both to the library and to J.P. Morgan. But she was only able to serve in this role and really ultimately become one of the most powerful people in the art world by hiding a huge secret. And that is that she was actually a Black woman passing as white. And this, of course, was the age, early 1900s, post-Civil War, post-Reconstruction, an age of segregation and sanctioned Jim Crow laws. Victoria, you want to take it from here?
Yes. And so that's who she was. That's the background, I guess, right, of everything of who she was. But Belle DaCosta Green then became, well, she was the daughter of Richard T. Greener and Genevieve Fleet, two very intellectual people. Richard T. Greener was the grandson of a slave, yet he was the first African-American to graduate from Harvard. Genevieve was part of the Fleet family in a section of D.C. that still exists, the Gold Coast. These were free Blacks who were very well educated. They had their own community. The women were all teachers, and men were all engineers. So that was who she was. But then at the age of 16, her parents split up because they disagreed on how to move forward from this point forward. Richard T. Greene still felt that even though the Civil Rights Act of 1875 had been overturned, there was still enough fight in him. He loved a country that didn't quite love him, but he saw the best of America. And his wife didn't. And she said, it's over now. And so after reporting them on the census as white, that was the end of it. That was a split. And Belle then became white, following in footsteps that her mother laid out for her. And so that's how she ended up even appearing in front of J.P. Morgan.
Yeah, it's such an interesting story. That time period, you know, when the Titanic sank and the banks failed, I feel like most of the time when you read a book, especially one set in New York, that's the focus. And I really appreciated how those things happen in the book, but they're really in the background and how they affect the Morgan family in particular. And these other political events become more centralized, some things I'd never even heard of. One of the things that happens is the parents are in South Carolina when they first get married because he's teaching there. And it feels like they're kind of pushed out as these things happen. And I, as someone who lives in South Carolina, that was very close to home, I would say. Do you have any sense of how these things affected the rest of the family? Ultimately, like, most of the children seem to be doing okay, but
I think we haven't traced the family in, you know, the decades since Belle's death, but certainly during her life, just like the parents, they were the children were very well educated. They all went to a college equivalent. The daughters were teachers for the most part. The only son that survived, Russell, was had multiple degrees in engineering. And it's our understanding that when Genevieve Fleet, Belle's mother, sent Belle on the path to live as a white woman, really everybody, all the siblings, started down the path of living fully as white instead of any kind of gray area. It's our understanding that they married white people, that they lived in white communities. And so you can imagine for Belle, who was the most successful financially, the most well-known of the family members, you know, when they made that decision to pass as white, they changed their names to distance themselves from Richard T. Greener. Certainly, if it had been known that he was their father, it would have been, the game would have been up, right? That it would have all would have been revealed. So it was important they switched their name to Green. Belle and her brother Russell added the name DaCosta as a middle name to suggest a Portuguese heritage because of the siblings. They were had the darkest complexion. The other ones were fairer, especially the youngest sister, Teddy. But much rested on Belle's shoulders, not just financially. I mean, she helped support her siblings and her mother in all different kinds of ways, even though they all had jobs of their own. But certainly if Belle, it became known that Belle was affiliated with, was Richard T. Greener's daughter, and was actually Black, then it would have been clear that her whole family was Black and the entire construct of their lives as white people would have been over.
So I'm guessing that wouldn't have just affected her job. It would have then affected the housing, the education, everything. Just everything.
Oh, absolutely.
Even though they were living in New York, this is one of the parts of the story that I find fascinating. We always think of Jim Crow in the South.
Right.
And it certainly was, but its tentacles reached across the country. Mm-hmm. And even in New York, they would have had to live a segregated life. And just by definition, that meant it would have been not equal.
Right. One of the things that was important to Victoria and I was, you know, this is a book set in the so-called Gilded Age, but the Gilded Age wasn't gilded for everybody. And, you know, very often when we look at this time period, we don't look, as Victoria said, at what's happening in terms of racism and segregation and sort of the tentacles of that reaching out really throughout the country and how that's affecting people like Belle and other people as well. But it was a time period that was actually much more textured and layered and much more difficult than is often given, depicted in books, I think, or in movies.
Yeah. And there's several times where J.P. Morgan is portrayed as anti-Semitic, which I believe I've heard before. You know, he uses some derogatory language, especially when Belle gets in a relationship with someone who might be Jewish. Do you think it's a fair assumption? Because as a reader, I was feeling like that must be a parallel to some possible racism too. Is that what we're supposed to kind of assume?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And I think, and Marie, correct me if I'm wrong, I think we didn't put anything in there directly because we didn't have anything directly. We knew about the anti-Semitic remarks, but we didn't have anything directly. But we assume, because we talked about that, and we just kind of assumed that, I mean, that was something that Belle would have had to see. She would know.
Exactly. Yeah, and it would have been, I think, you know, to understand the time period a little bit, it would have been very common to make those kind of remarks. And they would have been, there wouldn't have been any raised eyebrows. They would have just been normal. So as Victoria said, we wanted to keep true to what we knew. We knew that there had been some remarks along those lines of an anti-Semitic nature, but we didn't know specifically what he would have said about people of color, but we kind of made some assumptions or let Belle draw some assumptions.
Mm-hmm. She seems not to dislike him anyway, though. You know, she seems to have developed a very strong relationship with him. And I really enjoyed seeing how that affected the other people in her life, whether that was his family or the art world.
Right.
There's a lot of respect for her. I mean, she's a firecracker. I liked that a lot. As a person who's an academic librarian myself, I often read the research notes at the end of books with as much interest as the book itself. And I would love to hear more about that process. I know there were some things that had to be imagined and some things that you found evidence for. So I would love to hear more about that.
Marie is the expert on our research. Though I became good at the end.
Yeah, you're amazing. You know, with Belle, it's tricky. You know, I write about a lot of historical women who, you know, who've left us legacies, and I'm kind of rewriting them back into the historical narrative. So I'm always looking for that original source material if I can find it, letters, journals, and, you know, calendars, you name it. With Belle, there's not a ton of a personal nature, although she did leave behind a lot of business correspondence at the Morgan Library. Things that were personal, she burned. We think, I mean, this is kind of our narrative about Belle, but that she made a lot of sacrifices when she passed. She couldn't have a family. She couldn't have children of her own because it might reveal her secret. And given the very segregated racist society she lived in, she made those sacrifices for a larger purpose, for the legacy she was leaving behind with the Morgan Library. That's our Belle, right? And if people had read her letters, perhaps there would have been something in there that revealed her true identity. And as we imagine Belle, what would that have revealed? And what impact would that have had on her legacy, right? So you're starting with a situation where you don't have a ton of personal letters. The person to whom she wrote the most is Bernard Berenson, with whom she had a relationship. She asked him also to burn her letters. He did not burn her letters. He actually kept them, and they're all at Itati, which is the villa that he and his wife had in Italy that has been donated to Harvard. They are in the process of digitizing all those letters. When we wrote the book, those letters were not available unless you went there. And I actually had planned to go there to review them myself, although they are recounted in a wonderful, wonderful biography by Heidi Artizzoni. I hope I'm doing her name justice. An Illuminated Life. She went to Itati. She saw the letters. She, you know, gave synopsis kind of them in her own timeline and her biography. I really wanted to go and see them for myself. And I had planned to do so in this, you know, the spring of the first pandemic. So that obviously did not happen. So we relied very much on Heidi Artizzoni's recounting of those letters. And then when we couldn't find out anything from sort of the record we had of Belle, we cast our net a little bit wider and we looked at what J.P. Morgan was doing. Because sometimes if you look at what Morgan's doing, you might find out what Belle's doing, right? That's a trick I often use when writing about historical women, is look at the men in their lives and see if you can find out what's happening to the women, because sometimes you will, even if it's not directly about the women. And we looked a lot more broadly, sort of a Bernard Berenson's life and its intersection with Belle's, her father's life, its intersection with Belle's. So when we couldn't get at Belle's life directly through her letters, we kind of came at it a whole bunch of other ways to kind of cobble together what we hope, you know, it's definitely a fictional story. This is definitely our Belle, but grounded on a pretty strong foundation of fact. And of course, Heidi Artizzoni's biography was really helpful in that.
So Victoria, I know you usually write contemporary novels.
Yes.
So this is a different vein for you. So I'm curious too about even just adjusting to that kind of feeling, but also like, what things did you learn about research for this one?
Oh my goodness. This was such a great project for me. My agent and I had just been talking right before I started this project that I don't write to genres. I just write. I've written 30 novels that could fall, each one could fall someplace else. I just believe in writing what's in my heart, but now I'm in love with historical fiction and it's because of Marie. What I learned how to mesh fact with fiction when writing biographical novels, because the facts are very important. You want to stay, but you're not writing nonfiction. So you need to put in the fiction, but we stay true to the character. So for example, of the interview, we know that we know the day that Belle interviewed with J.P. Morgan, and we know that she got the job. But we don't know what was said in the middle of the interview or any part of the interview. So that part we had to imagine, but it was so much easier than I thought, because by then we had read the biography of her, and by then I had done more research on J.P. Morgan. So we just tried to be true to the characters, which is something I try to do even in contemporary fiction. Just always stay true to the characters, but these are real people. I learned how to research. I could spend 5 hours going from one article to another article, just looking for a little morsel. I learned all of that from Marie. I remember researching one time for like 5 hours and discovering that people thought she was from Cuba, and that was worth all 5 hours. I mean, I love the research part of this. I also learned a lot about the language. As a contemporary writer, I wasn't familiar with the early 20th century language and dialogue. So there were times when I would just write, "What's up, dude?" And that didn't quite fit. But what was so great about writing with Marie is she has something that we came to call her magical brush. She could take anything that you write, and she just with a brush can just suddenly, "What's up, dude," turns into beautiful language of the early 20th century. I learned so much, and I'm in love with historical fiction now.
That's so great. I remember the Cuba part coming up kind of by one of her antagonists, his daughter, right?
And, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then there were other secrets involved, so that was interesting.
There were. All of us have secrets, and the Morgan family is no exception. It was fun to just talking about Anne Morgan. You know, it was really interesting for us to delve into that relationship. You know, Belle almost became part of the Morgan family during JP's life, and as you know, Victoria and I imagined it. You know, what would that have looked like? What would that have meant to each of the different siblings, to his children, excuse me? And how would they have reacted? And would it have been positive, negative? What other factors? And that really allowed us to delve into other aspects. I don't want to give away too much, but other aspects of the Gilded Age culture that you otherwise might not have thought were real, but are actually very contemporary.
Yeah, I also was struck by Morgan's resistance to contemporary art. It's such a small thing, but he's so forward thinking in some ways, and then really much more of a collector in others. And so that traditionalism seems really important in the whole story and the conflicts that that brings up.
Absolutely.
Brings up some big conflicts.
Certainly. So one of the other things I zeroed in on, and it's little, is the librarian training. So she'd had an apprenticeship at the New York Public Library, which, by the way, they still do for librarians.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Because the whole apprenticeship idea, I feel like, is really gone by the wayside over the years.
I think they require it alongside a degree. But if you're in, I think you have to be from New York. But they have this great program that builds great librarians.
Oh, that's wonderful.
She'd taken a bibliography course, and then her 4 to 5 years experience at Princeton. I felt like that's a pretty good resume for a librarian, actually, you know.
I do too. I mean, there was no formal training at that time. They didn't have like degrees in library sciences, but I do feel like she was really well anchored in it. And Belle, as Victoria and I have talked about a lot, I mean, she was so bright and she was so nimble. She would eke every little last drop of information out of whatever, whoever, wherever she was. And I feel like she really did that at Princeton and then took that with her to the Morgan Library.
Thank you both so much for being here. Before we go, I wanted to also ask if there are any books you've read lately that you loved, or if you're reading anything now that you're really enjoying.
Well, we're both big readers, so we do share. But my book of the year and maybe for the last 5 years, is a book called Yellow White by Shadika Johnson. And it is amazing. It's a historical fiction set during slavery, but a part of that history that I didn't know. And it's a brutal, brutal read. Like, there were times when I was reading when I couldn't breathe. And it's the first book that I've read that ever made me think about my own personal ancestors. I've never read a book that ever made me think that it brought it down to Victoria. And I don't know why. I can't tell you what happened in those pages that made that happen for me, but it did. And it's also the first book I ever read where I had to stop myself from turning to the end because I just wanted to breathe. I couldn't breathe. And I didn't turn to the end. I'm so glad I didn't, but I came very close because I couldn't breathe. It's a wonder. It's so funny to be talking yes. about a book saying that it's brutal, but it's awesome at the same time. Yeah. One of the best books I've read.
That sounds great.
Yeah, and Victoria called me texted me as soon as she finished it. And I've read it now. Of course, it was already in my stack, but I have a long stack. And it's so moving. And in particular, I think, you know, I didn't realize there were going to be some hinted at issues of passing towards the end. And, you know, given how much time we've spent thinking and talking about that issue, it really resonated with me much more powerfully, I'm sure, than it would have before. And really made me think, because it's not a book about passing, but it does tangentially mention it. And it really opened up my eyes. Kind of like the book I was going to mention to you, which is Helen Oyoyemi's, I can't pronounce that right, Boy Snow Bird. It's like a retelling of the Snow White myth, a fairy tale, very differently with very modern issues. And it does delve in. I didn't realize this when I picked it up and started reading it, but once I started it, very interesting issues of passing as well. And really shed a lot of light on our own book and what might have happened in 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. It's definitely worth a read as well.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time, Victoria and Marie, the authors of The Personal Librarian, which is out now.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Jenny.
For recommendations on librarians and libraries, I turned to the people I work with every day because we all work in libraries. And so some of these are mine. Some of these come from colleagues. I have not necessarily read all of them, but it's a wide range. So first we'll start with books for adults. Caroline Mills, who's the director of libraries, recommends The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco. She says it's a great book, not a bad movie either. The description, the year is 1327. Benedictines in a wealthy Italian abbey are suspected of heresy, and Brother William of Baskerville arrives to investigate. When his delicate mission is suddenly overshadowed by 7 bizarre deaths, Brother William turns detective. His tools are the logic of Aristotle, the theology of Aquinas, the empirical insights of Roger Bacon, all sharpened to a glistening edge by wry humor and a ferocious curiosity. He collects evidence, deciphers secret symbols and coded manuscripts, and digs into the eerie labyrinth of the abbey. I read this book in the Dan Brown era because it was definitely one of the books people would recommend if you thought you liked The Da Vinci Code. They're like, try this. Another book, Lee Riel by Garth Nix. I'm so sorry. I don't know if I'm saying that right. That's recommended by librarian Mary Fairbairn. It's actually number 2 of the Abhorson series or trilogy, and it's specifically about the character Lee Riel, unable to see the future like her parents can. So she throws herself into becoming a librarian and discovers a prophecy about her in the library. Interesting. Elena Griffith, the guru of interlibrary loan and document delivery, recommends The Giver of Stars by Jojo Moyes. It's a gripping read about Appalachian packhorse librarians of the 1930s. This is her review. This has it all: historical basis, corporate industrial greed versus the dependent poor, including environmental consequences, tightly bonded, complex women's relationships, role of education empowering common people, illuminates the time and place with great character development and storyline. I just remember that around the same time that book came out, which I've read and it's very good, a similar book on a similar topic, probably inspired by the same story, is The Bookwoman of Troublesome Creek by Kim Michelle Richardson. So if you want to read about people delivering books on a pack horse, in the Appalachians, or the Appalachians, someday I'll get it right. Paige Dine, science and outreach librarian, recommends The Invisible Library by Genevieve Cogman. The description is, Irene is a professional spy for the mysterious library, which harvests fiction from different realities. She's posted to an alternative London to retrieve a mysterious book, but it has already been stolen. Dun, dun, dun. Robin Andrews, one of our circulation supervisors, says of Shadow of the Wind by Carlos Ruiz Zafón, if you haven't read it immediately. Set in Barcelona, 1945, and it's probably better just to let that one unfold. She also mentioned The Strange Library by Haruki Murakami. She calls it a quick little strange tale, and I would add that it's also fun from an art perspective because it's very unusual in how it's put together. Another book I'm going to recommend is Glaciers by Alexis M. Smith. I don't think this author or this book get enough attention. It's about Isabel. She's a single 20-something thrift store shopper and collector of remnants. It's very short. It follows her through a day in her life where she works with damaged books in the basement of a library, and she has unrequited love for the former soldier who fixes her computer, and she dreams of the perfect vintage dress, and it's all set in Oregon, if I remember right, although she's remembering Alaska, so that's where the glaciers figure in. I think I need to reread this one. It's been a while because I don't remember much about it, but that seems right. I also recommend The Borrower by Rebecca Mackay. It's about a children's librarian in Hannibal, Missouri, and there's a kid who's a patron of the library who runs away from home and needs her help. Another fun one that I think I read because of a postal book swap is called A Hidden Fire by Elizabeth Hunter. And it's about a young librarian archivist, Beatrice DeNovo, which that name just screams paranormal mystery romance, and a man named Dr. Giovanni Vecchio needs her help. It's pretty good. I recently read, actually listened to, American Dreamer by Adriana Herrera. It's a male-male romance. One of the characters owns a Dominican food truck, and one of the characters is a youth librarian at a public library. It's narrated by Sean Kristen, who does an amazing job at differentiating between Nesto and Jude, who are very different, but also very compatible. I definitely will continue reading books in that series. I would be so off base if I didn't mention Bear by Marion Engel, about a mousy librarian summoned to a remote Canadian island to inventory an estate. But that is not what the book is known for. So there are a few books for young adults. Jeff McCullough, who's a university archivist and special collections librarian at where I work, recommends Kitsy Babcock, Library Assistant by Joan Sargent. And it comes from a series called The Avalon Career Novels for Girls, and was published in 1958. Paige again recommends Sorcery of Thorns by Margaret Rogerson. And here's a description from the publisher summary. All sorcerers are evil. Elizabeth has known that as long as she has known anything. Raised as a foundling in one of Ostermere's great libraries, Elizabeth has grown up among the tools of sorcery, magical grimoires that whisper on shelves and rattle between iron chains. If provoked, they transform into grotesque monsters of ink and leather. She hopes to become a warden, charged with protecting the kingdom from their power. She must turn to her sworn enemy, the sorcerer Nathaniel Thorne, and his mysterious demonic servant. She finds herself entangled in a centuries-old conspiracy. Not only could the great libraries go up in flames, but the world long with them. Ooh, sounds good. Okay, and then I have a few recommendations for children's books about libraries and librarians. Both Robin Andrews and Libby Young, another one of our librarians, recommended The Library by Sarah Stewart. Elizabeth Brown doesn't like to play with dolls, and she doesn't like to skate. What she does like to do is read books, and now that she's grown up, her collection has gotten so big, all the shelves are collapsing. Her front door has disappeared entirely. What in the world will she do? That doesn't sound familiar. Mary, one of our other librarians, and her daughter Maggie recommend Penelope Popper, Book Doctor by Toni Buseo. I remember when she used that when she was in preschool, if I remember right, in the Child Development Center. Christy recommends The Midnight Library by Kasuno Kohara. Her kids, Ben and Katie, both love it, she says. They've checked it out so many times. It's about a little girl librarian and her three assistant owls who run a nighttime library for animals. She says it's so sweet, clever, and has high contrast, fun illustrations. I checked that one out to read. I haven't looked at it yet. Robin, again, recommends Library Lion by Michelle Knudsen. Miss Merriweather, the head librarian, is very particular about rules in the library. No running allowed, and you must be quiet. But when a lion comes to the library one day, no one is sure what to do. There aren't any rules about lions in the library. Robin also recommends Wild About Books by Judy Sierra. It started the summer of 2002 when the Springfield librarian, Molly McGrew, by mistake drove her bookmobile into the zoo. In this rollicking rhymed story, Molly introduces birds and beasts to this new something called reading. She finds the perfect book for every animal. Tall books for giraffes, tiny ones for crickets. This is a quote. She even found waterproof books for the otter, who never went swimming without Harry Potter. And the book that I added, one of my favorite Apple paperbacks from my childhood, is Help, I'm a Prisoner in the Library by F. Clifford. It's about two girls named Jo Beth and Mary Rose who spend an adventure-filled night inside the public library. So I would love to hear what books you have that you love that have libraries or librarians in them. I know we didn't make a comprehensive list here, but hopefully you'll find something that sounds good to try. And I definitely can recommend The Personal Librarian, which I read and enjoyed as well. So thank you so much for listening. And since this episode is likely to be kind of short, before I go, I'm going to give a few recommendations based on questions that I've gotten from listeners in the past few weeks. I don't usually do this kind of thing, but I'm trying it out because I do get emails from people, and I might as well just share that information with everyone. I won't share names in case it was intended to be confidential, but I did get an email in Goodreads from someone who asked me, do I have any recommendations for lesbian or queer/female-centered bodice ripper historical fiction? And so I said, have you already read The Lady's Guide to Celestial Mechanics by Olivia Waite? It's so fun, and it's the first of at least three books in the Feminine Pursuits series. They're all in that same era. The second book has older characters, which is rare. I also recommended that a lot of K.J. Charles would probably do. Her research is always super solid, and I haven't read this one, but it seems perfect. Proper English. It's Edwardian, bodice ripper, romance, plus mystery. The other question I got came in Instagram, and this person says, I listened to your podcast, I was listening to an old Goals episode, and I mentioned me that I couldn't find a book from Bahrain, so she recommended a few that she had found for that, which was great because I still haven't read a book from Bahrain. And then she asked if I had found any books for Oceania, Polynesia, specifically Nauru, Tuvalu, Kiribati, Vanuatu, Palau, Sao Tome and Principe, and the Solomon Islands. She's trying to find things written by people born in or lived in those countries. So it isn't easy. Most of what I have and know about, I can find things that are set some of those places, but not from people who live there. I went ahead and recommended them anyway, in case that's your only option. The People in the Trees by Hanya Yanagihara is set in Palau, but it's not Own Voices. The Sex Lives of Cannibals by Martin J. Troost is set in Kiribati, but I wouldn't recommend it. I hate it so much. He is making fun of the locals in the ways that I was not amused by, but it's the only book I know that's set in Kiribati. For Sao Tome, I have Equator by Miguel Sousa Tavares on my list. Not sure if he's from there. I do not believe so. And I read The Happy Isles of Oceania by Paul Theroux, and he visits quite a few of those places, but he's a travel writer. I read Serpent in Paradise from Pitcairn Island by Dia Burkett. It's about the place. She's more like a journalist. And for Samoa, again, I don't think any of these books are native. The Adventures of Vila by Albert Wendt. Might. And then I read Coming of Age in Samoa by Margaret Mead. It's just hard. It's hard to find local authors. I did tell her, although she already knew, that I keep shelves in Goodreads for every country that I have read any books from or that I'm intending to. So that can be a good resource for you as well. You can just Google me for Goodreads, but if you're in Instagram, it's in my link tree. Oh yeah, and I link to myself in every blog and podcast episode in the show notes, so you can find me there. I know that there are several like South Pacific or Pacific, Asia Pacific type book awards. That might be another resource that I haven't had time to really look into, but that's probably where I would head next. But thank you out there for listening and for contacting me. I appreciate it. Thanks for listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can follow me on Twitter at Reading Envy, or find a complete listing of our podcast episodes, as well as all of the books discussed on today's episode at readingenvy.com.